Okay, so picking back up, Genesis 17, we got to get to Genesis 25, so we have some room to cover. All right, so we got to finish the life of Abraham. That's what we need to do. All right, so chapter 17, we have the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. All right, circumcision. Okay, so again, what we have in chapter 17, we have the Lord kind of, again, repeating the promises to Abram. Okay, repeating them to him, confirming these promises. And you could kind of wonder, like, well, why? Like, God just did that, like, in chapter 15. Why does he need to do this again so shortly after? But if you notice something, right, how old is Abram in verse 1 of chapter 17? 99 years old. How old is he at the end of chapter 16? 86. All right, so between the end of chapter 16 and the beginning of chapter 17, 13 years go by. Right? 13 years go by. Long time. Okay? And some people argue that this might have actually been like actual silence from the Lord as kind of a judgment for what they did, like with Hagar and Ishmael, right? Of this kind of silence. And so then that's why you have God coming on the scene and telling him, like, essentially, like, walk before me and be blameless. Like, he's like, do what I've called you to do, kind of a thing, right? And so then he kind of again confirms and affirms this covenant, the promises in there, about having like a great nation and all these things. But this time he has a little more focus on, there's this emphasis on kings will come from you. There's this royalty aspect that's going to happen. Okay. And then he gives three signs to kind of confirm these promises. Okay. Three signs. The first being changes Abram's name to Abraham. All right, which now I can start calling Abraham. That's a lot better. All right, so Abraham, which means father of a multitude, right? Again, in the text says, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, right? Again, confirming this aspect of having offspring and nations and all these things, okay? So we see name change. Second sign is the sign of circumcision, right? Which shows that this nation is actually set apart for God. And his purposes, okay? And then third, Sarai's name is changed to Sarah, okay? Sarah meaning princess, right? Which has, again, this royalty aspect to it, right? This emphasis on that, okay? So he has those three signs that affirm all the promises that he is making, okay? And so then when God is finished talking, Abraham responds in obedience, right? Circumcises himself as well as his household, and obeys, okay? All right, and that leads into chapter 18, where we have the final promise of an offspring, okay? The final promise of an offspring. So we have, at the beginning there of chapter 18, Abraham at his tent, lifts up his eyes, sees three men standing there. He shows great hospitality to them, invites them in, gives them food, all that stuff. And we find out, kind of through this chapter and the next, that these three men are, one is the Lord, and two are angels, all right? Pretty good crowd, okay? And so, glad he invited them in, probably, all right? So, invites them in, they start conversing, right? Talking more, the Lord talking with Abram. And once again, you have the Lord promising, you will have an offspring, right? And notice, though, this time, as he is telling Abraham this, right, who overhears it? Sarah, right? And what is her response? She laughs, right? She laughs about it, okay? Laughs to herself saying, after I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure, right? Like, she laughs about it. And again, before we kick to judge her or something like that, right, if you look back in chapter 17, who also laughed when the Lord told them that they're going to have a son? Abraham did, okay? So both responded with laughter, okay, laughing about this, okay? But the Lord kind of confronts Sarah, asking, why'd you laugh? Don't you know, like, is anything too hard for the Lord to do, right? And so what he starts to point out is, not only does Abraham need to have faith and believe, but who else does? Sarah, right? And that's important as well, right? That she needs that faith and that belief as well, okay? And so again, he confirms that at this point next year, you're going to have a son. And in the previous chapter, actually, the Lord detailed that this son would be called Isaac. And do you know what Isaac means? Yeah, laughter, he laughs, kind of a thing, right? which again is that kind of play on both Abraham and Sarah laughing, right? God's like kind of like, I'll show you, right? Kind of a thing. And then also, but it's also the sorrow turning to joy, right? It will be a joyful thing. But then lastly, too, who gets kind of the last laugh in all of it? God, right? God does. He'll be the one that gets the last laugh with all of this. Okay? All right. And so we have this last promise before it's fulfilled a couple chapters later. And so then in the next section, this last part of chapter 18, we have Abraham's intercession for Sodom, right? So as these three men depart, right, Abraham kind of leaves with them for a little while, and we find out they're heading to where? Sodom, right? They're heading to Sodom. Why? To bring judgment on their wickedness, to kind of see if they are in fact wicked and judge them, okay? And we see Abraham intercedes for them, right? He intercedes for them, asking the Lord to spare the city, right? He starts out asking, like, hey, if you find, like, 50 righteous people there, can you spare the city, right? And then he kind of keeps winnowing down a little bit until he gets to, like, 10. And he's like, if there's 10 righteous people, please spare the city, all that. And again, why do you think Abraham is so adamant on wanting to spare Sodom? Because Lot's there, right? And who is Lot? His plan B, right? His backup plan, okay? His backup plan. And so, again, we see that there is still this struggle, right, to really fully believe God's promise of a seed, right? But he intercedes because of that reason, right? And instead, he kind of like, so he's kind of asking for God to save Lot without actually asking for it, right? You know, I kind of do that sometimes, right? But his plan doesn't really work, right? Because there's, like, not the 10 righteous people and all that, okay? And so he tries to intercede and all that because Lot's there trying to preserve Lot, okay? All right. And then we have Sodom and Gomorrah, chapter 19, okay? Where we have the two men, the angels, go there, okay? And we see that they are, in fact, corrupt. They are wicked. We don't have time to go into all the details of all that's going on here, right? But we see that they are deserving of judgment. And some people use this try to argue against this passage, saying that this doesn't condemn homosexuality and these things. But just real quick, point out here, notice in verse 5, as the visitors are there with Lot, Lot takes them in, the men of Sodom, kind of all of them in a sense, right, come, surround the house, and ask them to bring them out to us so that we may know them, right? And it's not to just get to know them, hey, how you doing type of thing, right? What we've seen throughout Genesis up to this point, right, is that action of, like, knowing someone in that way has been used, like, for not just sexual intimacy, but also, like, in the covenant kind of a marriage, right, where we see Adam knowing Eve, his wife. We see Cain knowing his wife, right? Like, and in that way, okay? And so what is going on here, right, is the men of Sodom are really perverting God's design for sexual intimacy in marriage, kind of a thing. That's what's happening. And Lot understands that, right? Because what does he offer instead of these two visitors? He offers his two daughters who have what? Not known a man, right? So again, some people try to argue this is like all about hospitality or something like that. Not what's going on, right? Not what's going on. And so it is being condemned here. It is wicked. It is sinful. And we see that the place needs to be destroyed, right? It needs to be judged. And so the two angels, right, essentially tell Lot, hey, gather your family, get out. We're bringing judgment, right? Like, fire's coming. Get out of here. And it's kind of interesting, like, it's crazy, right? Because you see Lot kind of, like, lingers a little bit, right? It's like, do you not understand, right? Like, judgment's coming, get out, right? Like, verse 16 says, like, even though the men told him this, what? But he lingered. And so the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, right? They essentially dragged them out of the city, like, you got to go, right? This is happening, okay? And they do escape, right? And Lot kind of tries to bargain and ask to go to a closer place, Zoar, right, type of thing, to get out of there. And the Lord is gracious, allows him that. And we see in verse 23, or verse 24, that the Lord then rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven and really destroyed those two cities. Okay? And something important to notice here, right? Look at verses 27 and 28. Right? 27 and 28. Would someone like to read those two verses, actually? Verses 27 and 28. Thanks, Brad.
Now Abraham rose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace.
All right. And so what would have been going through Abraham's mind at that point? What? They're all dead, right? Including who? Lot, right? Didn't have like text message, right? To like, hey, I'm okay, right? Like, no, he would have looked out, seen the destruction, and thought, he's gone. Right? He's gone. No more backup plan, right? That's essentially what the Lord's telling him. Like, no more backup plan. You need to trust me, right? No more plan B. You need to trust me, right? I'm sure eventually he finds out, right, that he's alive and all that, but he doesn't at that moment, okay? And on a side note, this is kind of an important thing, like, to even understand, like, in the context of, like, prayer and stuff, right? Because we can often sometimes assume when we pray for things, and we pray, and, like, I prayed so much for that, and the Lord never answered. But sometimes, what? He answers when we don't even know, right? Just like Abraham would have assumed, I tried to intercede, God didn't listen, right? He still destroyed the city. But what? God actually did listen. He answered what Abraham was actually asking for, right? And not he didn't spare the city, but he understood, you just want Lot out. And he got Lot out, kind of a thing, okay? So good for us to understand as well that we can learn from that. All right. And then the last kind of nine verses there of chapter 19, we have Lot and his daughters. This account, all right, where we see Lot goes up out of Zoar, right? He's afraid to live in there, and so he lives in a cave with his two daughters, and then the two daughters hatch this plan to get Lot drunk and then sleep with him to have children, right? Messed up, gross, yes, all that stuff, right? But what's significant about this is the kids that are born, right? One of them named Moab, who the Moabites, right, come, the nation of Moab come from. And then the other son, Ben-Ammi, which is where the Ammonites are from, right? Again, two of Israel's kind of enemies later on and all that, okay? But again, we see that this is not like a good thing. This is messed up. And kind of the names of the kids emphasize that, right? Because Moab can be taken as either from father or who is my father? Good question, right? And then Ben-Ammi is son of my people, right? Very literally, okay? And so that's what we see here, right? And we kind of are like, oh, that's weird and gross, whatever. Like, that's okay. But we have to understand, right, kind of the stigma that comes attached to all this. And who do we know is probably like the most famous Moabite in the Old Testament or Scripture?
Ruth.
Ruth, right? And so you can understand the stigma that would have been associated with her as Ruth the Moabitess, right? You're part of that people, right? That's gross. Those are the messed up people, right? And so you can understand that from the very beginnings, right? And that helps us understand what she has to deal with in that book of Ruth, okay? All right. Chapter 20, Abraham and Abimelech, all right? Abimelech. And so in a very similar situation, right? You might read this and think, I thought we already read this, where Abraham goes to a certain territory. This time he's like still in the land, which is good, okay? But he does the same thing where tells Sarah, hey, say you're my sister. This time it's Abimelech, right? He takes Sarah. God brings curses, right? And then Sarah gets returned and all that, right? And kind of the same scenario that we had before. And kind of the question of this is, what's going on here? Like, why do we have another instance of this happening? Okay? And kind of the reason for this is, when you think about it, when, like, kings want, like, a woman in their harem, what do you think they normally look for? Okay? Younger, beautiful, right? As well as ability to do what?
Conceive.
Yeah, conceive, have children, right? Someone who looks good and can have children, right? Does that normally describe people like in their 90s maybe? Yeah. No, right? Like, and he's not dumb, right? It's not like, yeah, he's not dumb. And so what do we have here is what? Sarah is now able to conceive and have children, right? In some way, God has, in a sense, made her young, right? Whether that's actually has made her young or just preserved her youth, whatever it is, right? But in some way, Sarah is now able to conceive, right? To the point where, like, Abimelech can recognize it. And that's exactly then explains what do we have in chapter 21 right after? The birth of Isaac, right? The birth of a son. And so we see that this is confirmed, right? So the whole point of chapter 20 is to kind of show that Sarah is now able to have children, right? That's kind of what is going on there. The Lord has worked in some way to allow her to have children. And then in chapter 21, we now have the birth of Isaac, right? Where God fulfills his promise to Abraham like 25 years later, right? Remember, he's 75 when God first called him, right? When he's 100 years old, 25 years later, God fulfills this promise, right? This fulfills this promise. And it will be through Isaac that the Abrahamic covenant continues. And therefore, again, remember, this connects with like the Noahic covenant, the promises of Genesis 3:15. All this is now linked to Isaac, right? It is him. And again, we see here that Sarah talks about, God has made laughter for me. There is joy in the birth of Isaac. And again, who has the last laugh in all of this, though? God, right? And remember, Isaac means he laughs. And God is saying, I told you so, right? You didn't believe, I told you so, right? And he's the one laughing last, right, in all of this. Okay, so it will be through Isaac that God continues his plan, continuing moving forward. And so then we see in the rest of, or not the rest of, most of chapter 21, right? We see then Hagar and Ishmael sent out. Okay, we see that it will not be, right, Ishmael that the plan continues, right? He is not the heir to like the Abrahamic covenant and all that. It is Isaac. But we see that because he is an offspring of Abraham, there will be still some sort of blessing tied with it. And that's what God promises here, that he will still make him into many nations, right? He will have a large amount of descendants, just kind of similar sounding as the Abrahamic covenant, right? But he has some form of blessing for being a child of Abraham, okay? So God will protect and kind of cause Ishmael to produce, right? And all that. All right. And so then we have, ending chapter 21, Abraham's covenant with Abimelech, okay? Where we see that there is this dispute, right, over kind of a well water and all that. And so they end up making this covenant, right, that Abraham is the one who actually made this well. He dug this well. And then they make a covenant affirming and confirming that this is the case, right, that Abraham has made this well. And they call the place Beersheba, which means well of the oath. Okay? And it's, again, just showing that he has essentially, like, the water rights over this region, right? He has this well. He has the water rights to this region. That's not quite the same thing as owning the land, but it's significant, right? Because you kind of need water to live, right? So he has the water rights to the land, though. And that's what's significant about this passage, because it's starting to move what promise of the Abrahamic covenant forward? The promise of what? Land, right? Now he has like these water rights. It's moving forward. It's progressing, okay? Everything seems like it's going great, right? Everything is going great. He has his son, right? He has Isaac. The land promise seems to be going well. And it's at that moment we have kind of the final test, right? Probably the most, one of the most famous passages of Abraham's life, right? The sacrifice of Isaac, okay? The sacrifice of Isaac, this final test. All right. And so you have to remember, right? And this is one benefit of kind of doing all of Abraham's life in one night, right? We get to see kind of all this unfold, where you have to understand, like, this isn't just a matter of him losing a son, right? That's dramatic. That is devastating in its own right, right? But we have to remember what all is linked with Isaac. It's not just the fact that he's Abraham's son, but also what? The covenant's linked with him. The Noahic covenant. All the creation blessings. Like, everything is like linked with him. Okay? And so essentially what God is asking of Abraham is what? To give up everything. Right? Not just a son, but everything. Right? And so you start to see how intense this chapter really is. Okay? And so are you going to be willing, Abraham, to trust me and be willing to lose everything? And trust that I will still fulfill what I have promised. Right? Are you going to do that, Abraham? And so we see this unfold, right? He calls out to Abraham, tells him to take your son and go, right, to the land that I will, or to the land of Moriah, right? Which hopefully sounds a little familiar to what? Chapter 12, when he said, go to the land I'm going to show you, right? There's a connection there. They're kind of bookends of this to show this is ultimately all about faith, right? From beginning to end, this is all about faith, and this is like the final test, the final exam here of faith. Are you going to trust me, Abraham? Okay, and we see that he calls him to take his son, right? And just like in the chapter 12, where he started from the general to the specific of like, hey, leave your country, your kindred, your father's house, right? He does the same thing here. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, right? And kind of with each painstaking description, right, you see what God is calling him to do, okay? So he calls him to take his son and offer, go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering, okay? Burnt offering is one that was wholly consumed, okay? And so he mentions the land of Moriah, right, which the name Moriah is only actually used one other time in the Old Testament, in 2 Chronicles, in chapter 3, where it refers to the site of where Solomon's going to build his temple on Mount Moriah, okay? And so we see this connection starting to form here that in this place where Abraham is to sacrifice Isaac, or actually ends up not sacrificing him, is the same place that later on sacrifices are going to happen all the time, right, in the temple, which again points eventually to the ultimate sacrifice of Christ, okay? And so this is just setting the stage for that, right? Of just laying that foundation, again, like we've seen in different times with Genesis, okay? But we see Abraham's obedience, right? Verse 3, what? So Abraham rose early in the morning and left, right? Gathered all the stuff, took some two young men with him and Isaac and left, right? And he went. He obeyed, just like he did at the beginning, right? And notice that this was like a three-day journey, right? It wasn't some quick thing. He had 3 days to kind of think about this. That would have been, I'm sure, agonizing the whole time, right? But again, the question of, is he going to remain faithful? Is he going to follow through? Okay, and as they get near the location, right, they see the mountain. They get near the location. They leave the two young men behind. And notice, though, what he says, right, in verse 5. Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. Wouldn't you kind of expect almost to say like, hey, we're going to go up there, we're going to worship, and I'll be back, right? Like, not we, right? But what? He says kind of like, but we'll come again, right? We'll be back, okay? And that's where you start to see Abraham's faith, right? Like in Hebrews 11, where he talked about that he believed that God could raise him from the dead or do something, right? And that's like his faith. And so we see that on display here. And so Isaac and Abraham continue forward, and Isaac kind of asks, hey, where's the offering, right? Like, we have everything else. Where's the offering? And this is where we need to point out something real quick about what's going on here too with Isaac. A lot of people, like, I think I grew up in, I think a lot of people think, like, this is, like, maybe just some small boy. Kind of like, yeah, let's go, you know, kind of thing. But a lot of people actually assume, like, he's probably more so, like, in his 20s, okay? And some people even argue that he might be in his 30s at this point, okay? So he's old enough to, like, catch on pretty quick of what's going on, right? And it also speaks volumes because, as such, once he realizes, oh, I'm the sacrifice, right? Like, what does he do? He goes along with it, right? He could have easily just been like, not today, old man, and like kind of overpowers him, right? You have this over 100-year-old man, right? I'm pretty sure he could have taken him, or at least ran off, right? Done something, but what? He goes with it, right? And that shows not only Abraham's faith, but whose faith? Isaac, right? The point here is Abraham's faith, but we can't lose sight also of Isaac demonstrating faith as well, okay? And then in verse 9, we kind of have, like, in verse 9 and 10, like, the narrative almost seems to, like, slow down a little bit, right? Where it kind of gives you almost every detail, right? Where it says, like, when they came to the place which God had told them, Abraham built the altar there. He laid the wood in order. He bound Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife, right? Like, it's kind of describing every moment, kind of to build that tension, right? That's intentional. It's building the tension, right? To the very moment that what? God intervenes, right? He's about to kill his son, right? But God intervenes. The angel of the Lord comes. Abraham, Abraham. And tells him, don't lay a hand on him, right? Now I know, like, you fear the Lord, right? That you have this faith. You believe me. You trust me type of thing, okay? And so then the Lord provides a ram instead, and they're able to sacrifice that as well. And before moving on, notice real quick in verses 17 and 18, very important verses that essentially confirm all that we've been saying all along, right? All these connections going on, where because Abraham has obeyed all these things, it says verse 17, I will surely bless you, right? Which again connects with the Noahic covenant, all these things, Abrahamic covenant, Noahic covenant, all that stuff. I will bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars in the heavens and as the sand that is on the seashore. Your offspring shall possess, or notice this last part here, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. Right? Some translations say their enemies, but Hebrew, it is singular. It is his, right? And once again, we have this kind of tension, right, between the many offspring, but then there's the singular, that there's an offspring that will possess the gates of his enemies, right? This point that there will be one offspring, there will be one seed out of the many who will conquer the gates of his enemies, right? And so what is that pointing back to? What promise is that pointing back to? Genesis what? Genesis 3:15, right? The promise of a seed, right? And so we see again that even though there's many seed and offspring, there is ultimately the one who is going to destroy the gates of his enemies, destroy and crush, as we saw in Genesis 3:15, the head of the serpent or Satan, right? And in verse 18, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, right? This connects it all together. All the promises of Genesis 3:15 and creation, the promises in the Noahic covenant, all that is tied into the Abrahamic covenant, right? All of it is tied there, okay? In this moment, and we have that all confirmed here. Okay? All right. We got to move. All right, we can do it. All right, so chapter 23. We have Sarah's death and burial. Some rabbis kind of joke and stuff about why Sarah died. It's that she found out what Abraham did, and she died of shock, but we don't know if that's true or not. But that's kind of the joke. But yeah, and so she dies. Abraham wants to buy a burial plot for her to bury her in, okay? And so we have this interaction with the Hittites, and maybe you're familiar with this, where Abraham's like, I want a place to bury my wife. And they're like, well, tell us where you want to bury. We'll give you kind of anything. He says, I want this cave, but I want to buy it. And then the person's like, no, take it for free. He's like, no, I want to buy it, right? Like, give it to me, like, give it to me in a sense, right? And then they kind of settle it. And we often read that as kind of like, oh, they're like so nice. They're just trying to give them stuff for free. That's awesome, right? These Hittites. But what we have to understand, right, of what's going on here is kind of back in this time, some scholars kind of talk about how kind of the way you were able to own land back then is you had to own land. Like, there was this prerequisite, like, to own land, you had to own land. You're like, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, right? It's like, you can only be in this club if you're in this club kind of a thing, right? And so in order to be part of this, like, association of landowners or type of things, you had to own land, and the only way to get into it is you had to own land. And so it's kind of this exclusive thing. And so then what, by offering these things for free to Abraham, are these people trying to prevent Abraham from kind of joining that association, right? Becoming a landowner, right? So that he can't own more land, right? But Abraham understands this, right? And that's why he's so adamant on, I want to buy it, right? Like, I'm going to pay whatever you want. Like, I want this land, okay? And so then they finally kind of cave, right? Ephron the Hittite says it'll be 400 shekels of silver, which is pretty much a ripoff, right? Because if you look like later on in the Old Testament, Jeremiah, he buys a field for like 17 shekels of silver. So 400 shekels for like a little field and cave, right? Like that's a lot of money, okay? And again, that's probably the point because they didn't really want him to buy the land, right? But he buys it, he pays for it, showing not only like his wealth, right? That Abraham is very wealthy, right? But also his firm commitment and belief in the land promise of God, that he's like, I want the land, right? Like, I'm going to pay whatever it takes because God has promised this land to me and I'm going to get it, right? And so it is showing that faith as well here, okay? And so he buys that land. He now owns the land. He is now a landowner, right? And can own more of the land. Again, God's promise of the land is moving forward. All right. Genesis 24, and now we see kind of the promise of the seed moving forward as well, right? We're in chapter 24. Abraham sends his servant to find a wife for Isaac, okay? Find a wife for Isaac, and essentially has two things that he says, like, hey, don't do this. One is don't take a wife from the Canaanites, right? He's like, go to like my relatives. Don't get a wife for Isaac from the Canaanites because he understands their wickedness and how the negative impact that will have on Isaac if he were to marry one of them. Okay, so he says, don't take a wife from the Canaanites, as well as then don't let Isaac leave the land. Right? Don't let Isaac leave the land. Why? Because he realizes that's not a good thing, right? From personal experience. Don't let him leave, right? Don't let him leave. This is his land. This is our land that God has promised. Don't let him leave. Okay? And so the servant goes, and you guys are familiar with this probably, where he goes and he prays when he arrives in the city, prays to the Lord that, hey, the woman that you want for Isaac, let her give me something to drink from the water of the well that she draws, and also let her then offer to give water to all my camels. All right? How many camels did he have, does it say? You guys see that?
10.
10, right? Can camels drink a lot of water? Yeah, right? I think I looked it up. They like average around like 30 gallons, okay, that each one can drink. So that's how many gallons? Do the math. 300 gallons, right? And again, that's not like today. You can't just like turn on a hose faucet and like fill up a trough. Here you go, right? No, you had to get it from a well, right? And most water jar containers were roughly hold about like 3 gallons of water. Okay, so you had to do how many trips? Do the math. 100, right? At least, right? Roughly 100 trips back and forth. And even what you have in some wells in that day, and it seems like based on the wording of verse 16, that this is what the case was there too, is some wells you would actually have to go down a set of stairs to go to like a reservoir that was underground, fill up your water, then come back out, right? And so can you imagine that? Someone having to go down 100 times, that's intense, right? That's exhausting. And so you can also see why this would be a clear indication to the servant, oh, this is the one that the Lord chose, right? And so what we see, right, it says before he had even finished speaking, Rebecca comes on the scene, who is part of the relatives of Abraham, okay? And she comes, he interacts with her, and she offers him the drink. And then notice in verse 20, after he had drank, she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And kind of most people say the implication is she just kept running like back and forth, right? Which you're like, that's impressive, right? That's very impressive, okay? And afterwards, the servant is very confident, like, this is the one. Like, thank you, Lord, right? Thank you, Lord. This is the one. It is clear. And so they go meet the family and all that. And the family kind of wants her to stay a little longer, but Rebecca knows, I have to go, right? And so she leaves with the servant and heads back to Isaac, okay, where eventually they do get married, okay? All right. And then in chapter 25, we have Abraham's death, okay? Oh, real quick, on chapter 24, important thing, verse 60, Notice when they leave, how her family blesses her. She says, "Our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate him." What does that sound like? Yeah, what God just promised Abraham, right? That his offspring would possess the gate of his enemies, right? Like, and so in the same way, and so this is again showing she will be part of this, right? This is part of God's plan moving forward, and Rebecca will be part of this as well, okay? And then verse 25, we have Abraham's death, okay? Takes another wife, has more kids, but he dies, and they bury him, okay? And then, real quick, the generations of Ishmael, just those kind of seven verses or so, we have here the generations of Ishmael just to show, right, that God was faithful to his promise, right? God was faithful, that even though Ishmael was not the elect son, that God continued his plan and covenant through, what? He was still faithful to provide some sort of blessing, right, where he made him have descendants, father of many nations, right, as he promised back in earlier chapters, right? And we see that unfolding here in these passages, okay? And that takes us to the generations of Isaac, which we'll cover next week. All right.